Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Robert Siegel, and this is On Point. The nuclear family, mom, dad, 2.5 kids, maybe a house in the suburbs and a white picket fence, is arguably the American dream, or it was. It's increasingly the dream of a bygone era. American households and families are very different today. There are more single-parent households. Couples are getting married later, if they're getting married at all. And even our definition of family is changing. Writing in The Atlantic, New York Times columnist David Brooks argues that the nuclear family, far from being a venerable social institution, enjoyed a brief time of dominance after the old-fashioned extended families broke up. This hour on Point, David Brooks joins us from Washington, D.C. to talk about his article, "The Nuclear Family Was a Mistake." David, it's wonderful to have you on the program and good to talk with you.
It's good to be on the air with you again.
We should acknowledge straight away that we spent many, many, many Friday afternoons, usually with EJ Dionne, either talking politics on All Things Considered or me listening to one of my colleagues talk politics with you on All Things Considered. And I miss that. So it's good to talk to you. And we also once took part in a small world experiment and discovered that we have 10 centimorgans of DNA in common. So we have a common ancestor sometime back around the time of the Black Death in Europe or something.
We are the extended family.
We are the ultimate extended family, yes, that you're writing about. Let's start with the precursor of the nuclear family, which you show us an example of it in your article from Barry Levinson's 1990 film Avalon.
You started without me? You cut the turkey without me? Come on, we leave. They start without us? We go.
Every year you are late, Gabriel. We were hungry. The kids wanted to eat. We were ready. We couldn't wait.
You're all flesh and blood and you couldn't wait? You cut the turkey? That's it. That's the last time we come for Thanksgiving.
Scene from a movie about a big sprawling extended family. I have to confess, David, on one side of my family, there were two great uncles whose clans did not talk to each other at family. They would come, but they wouldn't talk to each other. Tell me now, what was so great about those extended families? What was so good about that?
Big families were messy, of course, but they were close and infuriatingly close sometimes. In that movie, it's really about Barry Levinson's own family. He had five brothers come over from Eastern Europe, and they formed a wallpaper business together. And in the beginning, they all more or less lived together and supported each other, these big, sprawling tables. And the thing Levinson emphasizes, in those families, the grandparents were the storytellers. So there was family lore, which everybody was sort of united by. And then over the decades, America starts to happen. So some people move away in pursuit of opportunity. In this case, they break the code of the family. The guy who's saying, you cut the turkey without me, he was the senior male. He was the head of family. And the idea of cutting the turkey without him is to basically break up the family system. And so family becomes less important. Speed and efficiency become more important. And then toward the end of the movie, it's no longer a big table with extended family. It's a couple with their kids watching TV on Thanksgiving on TV trays. And then at the very end of the movie, the hero is left alone in a nursing home wondering what happened. And so basically the story of that is America moving from big extended families to small families and then to no family. And that's happened to a lot of people. I think that's basically the story that I think has happened over the last century, which has been fine for some people, but disastrous for those more vulnerable.
We should point out that one reason that people had smaller families was, first of all, they could, the advent of birth control. Another reason was that women became more empowered, and having eight children just made it pretty difficult to do any kind of work outside the house. Economically, children long ago ceased to be assets to the family. I mean, we love our children, but they don't bring money in when they're 10 years old the way they did in agrarian days. So that family, that old extended family, if it died a pretty natural death.
Well, it sort of did, but it died because farming ended, as you say, and we couldn't make money off our of our children, and the roles of women changed. And so with industrialization, you see people moving to the big cities and basically starting nuclear families, which is mom, dad, and one or two kids. It started out with four or five. Now it's one or two. And that is because extended families have a great strength, which is they're resilient. If one relationship between a mother and a father, or between a parent and a child breaks, or if somebody dies, there's somebody around to pick up the slack. Mm-hmm. In a nuclear family, the end of a relationship is basically the end of the family as we know it. So they allow for greater openness, but they allow for their much more fragile family structures. And so when we switched to the nuclear family, because of a lot of reasons you've cited, for a little while it worked. In the 1950s and 60s, it sort of worked. We had stable nuclear families, mom, dad, living in a suburban home surrounded by grass. And we had high fertility, low divorce rates. But that's because every condition in society favored that. You had men making 400% more than their fathers had at the same age, so you could have a stable family on one income. You had high social capital, high religious observance. You had everything to support the family, and the families were living in close proximity to one another, so they were basically forming extended families anyway. And basically, that was a brief window of time in the 1950s to 1965 when we formed our ideal of what a family should be. Mm-hmm. But then in 1965, society went back to normal, and the security of those brief freakish years vanished. And since then, the family has been falling progressively weaker and weaker.
One change was that to maintain the extended family means generations remaining in the same place. And we're a mobile society. I think of in my lifetime, two professional decisions that were absolutely decisive were moving away from New York to Washington, going off to London to live for 4 years. You can't do the same. You can't have the same kind of week-in, wake-out relations with your family if you're living hundreds or thousands of miles away.
Yeah, that's certainly part of it. America at least used to be a mobile society. We're now much less mobile than we used to be. But I think people left the nuclear family in part because, A, they wanted privacy. They just didn't want all these people they didn't choose in their lives. And, B, they wanted a little more flexibility. And the market wants you to be in a small family where you don't spend a lot of time on relationships, where you can spend a lot of time on work emails. So nuclear families make you richer, and societies with smaller families are richer families. They happen to be less connected families. And the story I tell about the last 50 years, really, is a story of these families falling apart. It used to be like 70% of Americans were living in a nuclear family. Now it's like a third. Fertility rates are way down. You have 27% of young men having no contact with their dads. You have 40% of Americans growing up in a single-parent home. And so what you have wound up with is a lot more fragile relationships. And you've wound up with, say, single moms. I have a friend who is a mom who's decided to stay home with her kids in a suburb of Virginia. And she describes a life that is brutally hard and lonely a lot of the time because there's nobody around to help. You've got older people who are dying alone. My newspaper wrote a piece in about a decade ago about a guy who lived in Queens, and he just died alone, and nobody noticed because he had no social contact.
Yes. So we are we live with more anomie in modern society, where we are individuals, and yet that choice, as you say, the allure of all of that was, again, to draw upon my own family. My mother was the eighth of eight. Eight surviving. There was an earlier baby who died in infancy. Of those eight siblings, four of them had one child and four of them had two children. Nobody wanted to replicate the life in a brood of siblings and cousins, although it was a very happy family. But it just – that was not being American. It wasn't assimilating. It wasn't being modern for them.
Yeah, and my family is pretty much the same. And I would say just looking around the society, that's basically fine if you're upper middle class. That people, frankly, in my social class, we can afford to buy extended family. And when we need labor in the form of nannies or coaches or somebody to cut the grass, we can afford to hire that. And so the nuclear family has worked out pretty well for those of us in the educated class. For people who don't have the means to basically buy extended families, it has not worked out at all. And so you go to neighborhood after neighborhood where you see stressed families, and then you see people trying to cope. And the story ends on, I should say, on a hopeful note. that Americans are adjusting and reattaching to extended yes. families. So the number of Americans who live in extended families is now 20% of the population, 64 million people. That's a modern high. And that's because a lot of parents want their adult children, and a lot of adult children basically have no choice but to live at home. And a lot of middle-aged people want their parents to live with them. And so you're seeing a return to a new kind of family form. So we did go through that period, which your family and my family probably mm-hmm. did at about the same time, of just smaller and smaller families. But I think out of the wreckage of that, for a lot of people in a lot of social classes, you're seeing new family forms.
Yeah. Actually raising a challenge of what kind of housing there is in America, and how can an extended family live nowadays if all the housing that's being built is for nuclear families?
Yeah, home builders ask consumers, do you want us to build an in-law suite where either what they call a millennial suite, where the adult child can live or the senior can live? And 42% of Americans now say they want that. And so I do think there's a return to that. And the second thing, which is even more hopeful to me, is what I call forged families, or what somebody calls forged families. And that's yes. chosen families. And chosen families emerged in the 1980s in San Francisco during the AIDS crisis. A lot of gay men, lesbians were cut off from their families going through this trauma. And they really created this chosen family structure where they bonded together to really create kin-like forms. And a lot of people have been sort of cast off among some of the failures of the nuclear family, and they're forming new family forms, these chosen families. And I see those all around the country emerging as people bond together and create family out of, even though they're not biologically related.
In a few minutes, I want to return to that subject and hear more about the forged family. Let me first tell folks that we're hearing from New York Times columnist and Atlantic writer David Brooks. We're talking about his latest article in The Atlantic, The Nuclear Family Was a Mistake. Were you raised in a non-traditional family? Or are you starting a non-traditional family? What works, what doesn't work in your case? I'm Robert Siegel, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Robert Siegel, and we're discussing the American family with New York Times columnist David Brooks. His latest piece in The Atlantic is called The Nuclear Family Was a Mistake. And joining our conversation from Winston-Salem, North Carolina, is Dr. Andrea Hunter. She's a professor of human development and family studies at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. Andrea, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
You've researched the phenomenon of the family and the extended family in African American society, which is it's a different story. Describe the role of the extended family for African Americans.
Certainly. Well, first, let me say that I've studied African American family systems over the last two decades at UNC Greensboro, and perhaps even more important, I was raised in one, in an extended multi-generation household embedded in a broad extended family. And I just want to say first that David certainly points to the demands and challenges that families are facing today. And I certainly agree that this 1950s invention of the nuclear family chafes under those demands. But I do want to offer a different kinds of lens based on my work with African-American families, as well as my own experience in these families. And that is that the lived experience of families is not one where the nuclear and extended family are bifurcated or on different poles. Rather, they are really dynamically connected in complex ways. And these connections exist, you know, within households, across them, they straddle them. And so, and these connections can be very malleable and fluid or more bounded. And certainly they're informed by culture and tradition. And so when we begin to think about the African-American families, this certainly has been a centrally important ways in which families have been organized. They've been a source of resilience, as David notes, a source of cultural continuation and survival. It certainly has helped African-American families deal with difficult social and economic dislocations and social and economic marginalization over time. And in many ways, African-American families, marriage, and gender has looked quite different and has not approximated that 1950s social invention. So in that way, I think that African-Americans reflect the ways in which this kind of family tie can be critically important. At the same time, we can think about the ways in which the extended family and nuclear families sort of are mutually constituted. Mm-hmm. And think about that flow and ebb. So I'm less likely to sort of think about the kind of decline in the nuclear family, the disintegration of it, and the ascendancy of the extended family system, but rather to think about them in very mutual ways as a resource through which individual family members and also nuclear family units can draw on to build their adaptive capacity.
David Brooks, sound right to you?
Yeah, that's a beautiful way to put it. I think in just the way I expressed myself, and maybe even in the article that I wrote, mm-hmm. I imply that they're two different things. An extended family is a nuclear family with supports. The nuclear family is not going to go away. We're always going to have moms and kids and dads. I think the crucial question is what you support them with. And in the 1950s, and in many of our minds today, the ideal is to, you know, kids with parents in a house that's sort of detached and that is sort of self-sufficient. But that's never been the case with the African-American community, with family forms that were necessary under slavery, with family forms that were necessary under Jim Crow. There was a struggle to find ways that were much more resilient and much more supportive. And I try to mention in the piece that there have always been grandparents involved. There's always been aunts and uncles. I spent a lot of this week in Watts and Compton and South Central L.A., which are African-American and Latino communities. And I guess I'd say you see two realities. One, you do meet young men who say, you know, I hate my dad. He's not around for me. On the other hand, you see people of all forms of and all over chipping in and creating relationship with young men and women, raising children in ways that are adaptive, flexible, and successful. And so I'd say those two realities, the sort of the disadvantages that a lot of young people grow up with are real. The family breakdown is real. But the family adaptation is also very real.
Let's hear from some of our listeners. Cindy is on the line from Sterling, Massachusetts. So you hear things that relate to what's happened in your family, Cindy?
Definitely. My husband and I just left our community in the North Shore of Boston to move out to Central Mass to buy a home with an in-law apartment so that we could live with my mother-in-law. And there is, you know, despite the classic angst between mother-in-laws and daughter-in-laws, I was really the one who spearheaded this. I had recently taken some time off work to stay home with my kids, and I just found the isolation and the burden of taking care of my kids by myself, especially as a woman with like the mental load and balance, like everything I have to take care of that's assigned to me, essentially, because I'm a mom and a wife. I just found it really stressful. And we decided to to make the move. And my mother-in-law is recently widowed, and she couldn't take care of herself and her house anymore. And I'm, you know, thrilled. My kids are going to be able to be with their grandchildren, and we're going to be able to help her, and she's going to be able to help us.
She can have four generations under the same roof at times.
Yeah. And I'm just, you know, I'm so glad about it, because it was just, as a stay-at-home mom, temporarily, hopefully, it was just too much. Like, the loneliness, the isolation, like, and depression I experienced. And, you know, so I'm hoping that it's going to be great for all of us.
Well, thanks for talking with us about that. David, although Cindy described redeveloping, recreating an extended family to lessen stress. Do I have it right? There's a point in your article that in Japan, there's a study finding that women who were in multi-generational families were more stressed out than other women. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that is correct. And so in the old extended family of Avalon, those families were possible because the women were stuck in the kitchen making meals for 25 people. And we're not going to go back to those days. And frankly, we're a much more individualistic culture. We're not going back to the extended clans of 1,500 years ago. So what we're trying to do is find a new balance. And I think we've sort of overshot the mark on isolation and separation. And one of the things I liked about these new forged families and these new extended families is they're not as crushing, especially for women, as the old ones. So, but they're not as isolating as the nuclear family we wound up on, and the flexibility is part of that.
On the other hand, and perhaps Sandra Hunter, this you've encountered this as well. One used to perhaps have a parent come and live with you because the parent was old or widowed, both of those things. But it wasn't just about nursing. It wasn't a matter of caring for somebody who's ill. And that seems to be increasingly what's happening here. It's not just that mother is old, but mother is frail and needs constant attending to.
I think what you see in African-American families is extending in lots of different ways under different conditions. So you may have elder kin bringing in young families to provide that support. You may have aunts and uncles as coming in as they make a transition to other points in their life, or a young mother. And you may have families working together to support an elder kin. And one of the things that within this environment, you share caregiving, you grow through this ethic of care. And I think as someone who also grew up in one of these families, I think about how deeply I've been shaped by those intergenerational stories. And those intergenerational stories are about my culture and identity and family, but they are imbued with so many values around how we treat each other, how do we deal with these difficult circumstances. So I would say one of the models that comes out of the African-American family, and then the ways in which people are creating new families, is that we're doing it in lots of different ways. There's a lot of complexity. There's one study that I was involved in, and there were 108 different combinations of adults living with children. That's not even talking about the cousins, you know, the minor cousins and nieces and nephews and the fictive kin. So I think we're in an age of possibility. And I think that the ways in which we can think about family in these expansive ways opens up not only the chosen family, but for us to activate this extended family that lives alongside us.
Victoria joins us now from Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I was calling in because I'm sure a lot of immigrants are in a similar situation, but my husband is from Moldova, a small town in a small country in Eastern Europe. And he really came here with no family. And we know a lot of other people from the same country. And it just kind of naturally happens where we create a new family. So we spend holidays with people from the same country. We get closer with those people, almost like we cannot spend time with our immediate family overseas. And you almost reach out to those coming from a similar background, and you really do create almost this new kind of family where everyone's in the same situation. Most of the people that we know don't have any family here either. So I'm sure that a lot of other people, and my mom is also from Brazil, and it's the same thing. Growing up, we just seem to, you know, people from the same area just gather together and almost create this new community and family.
I mean, David Brooks, this is something that you write about, which is people who really, even if they wanted to, could not reassemble their extended family. It's just not around. But who do then create an extended family? They construct one.
Yeah, I'm in one myself.
I wanted to hear about that.
Yeah, so I went over to a house in D.C. Maybe 6-7 years ago now, and the couple named Kathy and David, and they had a kid who was in D.C. public schools, and he had a friend who had no place to live or eat, and so they said, well, James can stay with us, and then James had a friend, and he had a friend, and so on, and so by the time I came over there, there were like 25 kids around the table and a bunch of them sleeping in the basement. And we have an extended family. We call it AOK DC, all our kids DC. And we have had dinner every Thursday night. We celebrate holidays together. We vacation every year on Cape Cod, as it turns out. We basically do life together. And frankly, those kids are now, it's been years later, and they're now in their mid-20s, and maybe they need us less intensely. And I'm missing that. And my wife and I talk about this. We've got to find another family, another extended family to be part of.
You know, David, if the nuclear family was a mistake, it was one of the biggest, most extensive mistakes in American history. It's bigger than bad wars that we've gotten into. I mean, it included generations of Americans.
Yeah, and for many people, of course, it worked out. But if you look at the doubling of the depression rates, you look at what it's the inequality of family form is responsible for about 25% or 30% of the income inequality in this country. It's led to the wider inequality between African Americans and whites. It's had led to a lot of loneliness in senior citizens, a lot of hardship for moms. It's hurt the most vulnerable more than us. Until about 1960, rich families and poor families looked alike. They had the basic same family structures, the same divorce rates, the same marriage rates. Now they look nothing alike. And so rich people have pretty stable families, and poorer people are much more likely to divorce, much more likely to never get married. And so we have these two different family regimes. And I think that's because we adopted a bad ideal. And I just want to emphasize, we're not getting rid of the nuclear family.
Yeah.
But when we think about what life do I want if you're a young adult, should it be two adults in a home with a kid in the suburbs? Or should it be a part of a more extended network like the African-American families have built and that a lot of immigrant communities have built? And I would say if you haven't won an ideal in your head, think of the latter. That's just a better ideal, a better way to orient your life.
I should add here that I also experienced in my childhood, and I know that another place where our paths crossed, not knowing each other then, we at some point you lived in the same neighborhood that I did. In lower Manhattan, apartment house living actually connects you to a lot of people very closely. You may find very close friends on the same floor of the building, and it's an experience that my daughter and her family are living through right now as they have lived in a kind of almost a communal situation for several years with their neighbors. So there's always that option to move into an apartment. Think of that.
You guys are luckier neighbors than I lived in New York much of my life. We never knew our neighbors. There was like a code of let's leave each other, let's give each other privacy. And frankly, a lot of the neighborhoods I live in now, if you knocked on somebody's door at 8 p.m., that would be considered an outrageous violation of privacy.
Yeah. And for that matter, if you called them on the phone, if you called them on the phone after 8 o'clock at night, that might be considered an outrageous violation of their privacy. I guess we have about a minute to hear from Kitsy, who's in Portland, Maine. Kitsy tells us she is 81 years old.
I am, and thank you. I grew up in a house, a privileged white home in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I thought I was weird as a child because we always had other adults living with us. And then when I was in college at Radcliffe Harvard, I came across Margaret Mead, the great a cultural anthropologist who talked about how what a bad institution the nuclear family was. And she highly recommended groups of maybe up to 19 people living together. And one of the things she said would be wonderful is some mothers are not, would rather have a career and not stay home with kids. And some men would love to stay home with kids and do that. And she said you could do that and support the entire family, however large it was. And I thought, gee, as a child, I grew up with a bit of that. And when I got married and had children, we found a way without even being intentional of having other people living with us. It was so much healthier for the children as well as for me as a mother.
That's a great story. We've been discussing the American family with David Brooks and also with Andrea Hunter, professor of human development and family studies at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. Dr. Hunter, thank you very much for joining us in this hour.
It's been great. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And we'll hear more from David. His latest piece in The Atlantic is called The Nuclear Family Was a Mistake. I'm Robert Siegel, and this is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Robert Siegel, and we're with New York Times columnist David Brooks, whose latest piece in The Atlantic is called The Nuclear Family Was a Mistake. David, some comments we've heard from our website. Jabbermocky writes, winner take all, killed the family, men change their minds, why share anything when you can grab everybody's and start a new family or affair at a whim? And Emily Brown writes, this is interesting because my extended family is extremely close and extremely matriarchal. I actually think the existence of such allowed me to be far more successful than if I'd only had my nuclear family. I'd like to ask you, what's the big difference, do you think, in kids who grow up in the extended family, the kind of families we've heard described, and kids who grow up in an intact nuclear family? Do you think there are life skills that one imparts that the other doesn't?
Well, I don't want to make a bifurcation or a generalization, but I do think, and I would make the difference between kids who grow up in no family, because I think the problem with the nuclear family is not that if you can have a stable nuclear family, you're doing great. The problem is its fragility, and so it winds up with no family and kids who are latchkey kids or who have one parent who have no contact with another parent. And while we all know single moms and single dads who are doing amazing jobs raising their kids, on average, the kids who grow up in those homes, they do less well in school, they have more emotional problems, they have lower life outcomes. Raj Chetty has data that if you grow up in poverty with two married parents, your chances of getting out of poverty are 80%. If you don't, your chances are much, much lower and the odds are against you. And so I'd say those are the people we need to worry about most. And I would say just in general across society, I think we've gotten less good at relational skills. I'm really puzzled over the spike in suicide, up 30%, mm-hmm. the spike especially in teen suicide, up 70% or 50% or so. The spike in depression rates. Every college I go to, the mental health facilities are swamped. I confess I don't completely understand what's going on here, but there's been something that has weakened our relationships and had the predictable effect on our emotional health. And I think that's somewhat related to what's become of family forms.
You have been devoting a lot of energy in recent years to investigating issues of community, of virtue, of kindness among Americans, and you've written also about very much about the spiritual side of this for you and what's been going on in your life. Does the forged family that you described earlier, does it have a spiritual dimension for you? Is it something you take part in do so with your soul in mind, not just your desire for conversation and company?
Yeah. I mean, I do. I mean, I think when you get, hopefully, you stop being a stuck up middle-aged white guy like I was and get a little more emotional and a little more spiritual, and you discover the desires of your heart, which is the desire to really connect deeply with others, and the desires of the soul, which is to serve some good, to feel in right relationship with the good. And in my column, everything I was writing about came down to social isolation and fragmentation, whether it was political polarization, rising suicide, rising opioid. We're just in a crisis of solidarity. And so I started something called Weave, the Social Fabric Project at the Aspen Institute. You can go visit us at weareweavers.org. And basically, we want to lift up people and learn from people who are just phenomenally good at building solidarity. And they're not just building connection, like warm relationships, though that's very important. They're building solidarity, a sense of spiritual loyalty to other human beings, and leading a life that really is, it's corny to say, but leading with love. What the weavers do is they treat neighbors as if they were kin. They treat non-kin as if they were kin. And though when I see all the fragmentation and hatred in our society, I look at the weavers and they are the solution. And I just try to wish we could change the culture so more of us embrace their values and embrace their lifestyle. It's just a better way to live.
Do you find those invitations of kinship-like relationships are generally received, or is it like the New York apartment dwellers you spoke of earlier who would just as soon not be bothered?
It's tough because a lot of the people they're trying to reach have been betrayed so much that their instinct is, oh, if you show up in my life, you're going to leave. You're going to betray me. And so they've been, you know, educated by very bad experiences and by betrayal. One of our weavers is a woman named Sarah Heminger, who runs an organization called Thread in Baltimore, which really creates social networks around underperforming kids in the Baltimore schools. And it takes a while before the kids will trust. And she says it's identity changing when somebody keeps showing up after they've rejected you.
Yeah.
But it's also identity changing to be the one rejected. And so what they do is that you create much deeper bonds of relationship. But you have to overcome a lot of fear and a lot of skepticism in order to get there because of what's already happened in our society.
You have written quite a bit about your own life. And I'm curious, one of us is being contacted by a member of his community here.
Sorry.
I'm not sure who it is. I'm just curious, in the kinds of structures that you're now involved with, do your now, I assume, adult children, are they attracted to this at all? Or do they still feel, hey, you know, we're part of what was a nuclear family that broke up?
Yeah, I think when they gave it the cover line, the nuclear family was a mistake, I immediately texted all my kids, hey, not ours. And so I think they understood that. And I would say that as they've gone through life and they're now in their 20s, they have found their own versions. My daughter, when she was 5, she walked into a hockey rink and felt immediately at home. And she now works for the Anaheim Ducks teaching hockey to kids. And I just visited her out there. And I would say that team and the teams she's part of around those rinks, they're really tight bonds of affection. And they speak in familial forms. And so I do think young people today, including my own kids, are finding that. My oldest son served in the Israeli Defense Forces. And certainly anybody who serves in any sort of military experience, that's family, and that's probably family that's going to last you a lifetime. And I do think there's a great hungering for really intimate bonds, unconditional love. And people are finding it in ways because that's how we're wired.
Amy is on the line from Tampa, Florida. Amy, what's your reaction to all this?
A lot of resonance. I am an older mom of a special needs toddler, and the nuclear family's fragility is front and center. We recently experienced the flu, and as a family, we were debating about whether to go to the ER because we didn't have any help. And I believe we may be relocating to DC Metro, where we've lived before, as a couple and also as single people, we're going to be experiencing that region in a completely different way. Housing is astronomical. Since having this child, I have experienced typical, new motherhood plus medical issues. And I've been driven to look into intentional communities and co-housing. There are a couple in Silver Spring. And I would like to hear your thoughts about how important that is in the face of an aging population and also in the face of parents, older parents of special needs children, and children who will be ultimately needing a supportive living environment even after those parents pass. Thank you.
David?
Yeah, I write about co-housing communities in the piece, and basically they're usually a bunch of apartments together. The one I write about is in Oakland called Temescal Collins, which has 23 people in it, ranging from age 1 to 83. And they have a gigantic common kitchen. They eat together maybe twice a week together, and the rest of the time they just eat within their own apartments. They have a common garden. They have a common play area. And in that particular co-housing community, there's a guy who's a nurse. And one of the moms told me, you know, I can knock on his apartment door at 1 in the morning, have my kid held in his arms and say, should we take him to the ER or not? And the nurse is very happy to give that advice, even in the middle of the night. And so that's the kind of support. And the other thing that some of the residents told me about that place was you have a lot of friendships across the age. A woman I talked to named Courtney Martin has a little girl, and her little 3-year-old daughter just has a wonderful relationship with one of the adult males, and the guy loves the fact that a three-year-old thinks he's fantastic, and the girl loves the fact that she's got this funny guy who plays with her all the time. And so the sort of multi-generational connections that used to be part of life are much more part of these co-housing communities.
Sally is on the line from Haverhill, Massachusetts. Sally, what's up?
Hi. I just want to say I married into a lovely, large Italian family. We ended up moving away just because our free time was never our own. It was always scheduled with family events, and they're wonderful people. But it turned out we just didn't have our own lives.
Yeah. David, there's that. I guess Sally is experiencing something a few decades after a huge number of people have experienced that, which was the notion is the big family, the big multi-generational family, can it be suffocating? Do children not get the kind of attention from their parents that they would in a nuclear family? And I'm wondering, when you think of what the different experiences do for kids who grow up in them, what about that problem?
Yeah, I think they can be more suffocating for the adults. I think the kids are fine having squads of other kids to run around and play with, but I think the adults can find it suffocating. You're basically forced to live with people you didn't choose. Often there are feuds, and often, like, even we started with a story of a guy who didn't cut the turkey at the right time. That's a seemingly trivial thing can create years of feuds. And so I don't want to say that life in extended family is always neat and nice. And a lot of the weavers we work with struggle with burnout because they're always giving, 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 and they don't have a sense of a place to relax, a place to do self-care. And so I don't want to totally romanticize these things. And I'm a person, I think our values have changed, and I certainly live with modern values where I expect a certain level of privacy, a room of my own, a quiet place. Yes. And those are often not around in extended families. So there are pluses and minuses to both forms. I guess my argument would be we've gone a little too far over in the direction of privacy and separation and isolation. And it's been especially bad for our kids.
We're talking about family with David Brooks, whose article is called The Nuclear Family Was a Mistake. One difference between a nuclear family, let's say, and a large number of people who've come together to live together with a variety of connections is that they're at the heart of the nuclear family was a marriage. And in fact, when I was a kid, they hadn't yet liberalized the divorce laws. So divorce meant a trip to Nevada, and it was really a privilege. The poor just did desertion instead of that business. Now, people who come together in a variety of new forged ways haven't stood before, before their community and pledged themselves to one another. What holds them together? Do people drift in and out? Is it a different degree of association?
There is a different degree of association. It's much easier to drift in and out, and they are definitely more fragile than marriages, which are a little fragile anyway.
Yeah, pretty fragile.
And so I don't want to – but I think people are looking – but on the other hand, I think the forged families are not just roommates. And if you go on Pinterest or something and write in chosen families, you'll see all these placards and other things for people who are in chosen families who say that family isn't just blood. It's people who will be there for you unconditionally. And I do think a lot of these people who are in forged families or chosen families, it's not quite as tight a tie as the blood tie, but it can be a pretty tight tie. And it's a sense of, and if you go back, and I mentioned this in the article, if you go back through human history, if you looked at the extended clans that humans lived in for most of our history, there were a lot of non-kin there.
Yeah.
They created kinship by eating together, and that gave them a sense of kinship. They created kinship by migrating somewhere together. They created kinship by being through an ordeal together. And so our modern idea of kinship is not the historical norm for centuries and centuries and thousands of years.
I'm just worried in about the minute that we have left. I mean, I'm curious, when you think ahead another 50 years, do you imagine a great proliferation of these forced families, recreated extended families, and a real diminution, a further diminution of the nuclear family? Or do you suspect that it's, we're in some kind of stasis right now? What's your view of, will these situations like the one you're in be like, the communes of the 1960s or the salons of, of Paris at a different time?
Yeah,
or the mainstream.
Like the hippies in the 60s. But I would say one of the things when I spoke to so many family scholars for this piece, family structure is always changing. And there's no simple line you can draw through. It's always evolving. And I would just say if you look at the history of family in over the last 200,000 human years, we're at the very extreme of smallness.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we eat at small tables. And historically, people have eaten at bigger tables with more people. And I do think that the trend right now, and I think the culture has shifted away from a culture of hyper-individualism to a culture where people are really looking for connection. And I think they want to find ways to eat at bigger tables.
What a wonderful image. David Brooks, thanks for talking with us today.
It's been a great pleasure, and a great pleasure to be with you again, Robert.
Yes, good to talk with you. David Brooks' latest piece for The Atlantic is called The Nuclear Family Was a Mistake. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're taking voicemails also for our Friday News Roundtable, and we want to hear from you. Do you have a question about President Trump issuing a round of pardons or former DOJ prosecutors calling for Attorney General Barr's resignation or the Democratic debates? Leave us a voicemail at 617-353-0683. I'm Robert Siegel, and I've been sitting in this week on point for Meghna Chakrabarty. She returns to the program on Monday. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Jesse Daum, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonitz, Brittany Knotts, Wes Martin, James Ross, Dori Scheimer, Grace Tatter, Adam Waller, and Sidney Wertheim, with help from Carol Love and Bradley Noble. I'm Robert Siegel, and I'm retired again. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.